Chapter 61. But they knew very well that he must have a parliament now, and he began to make that discovery too, though rather late in the day. Wherefore, on the 24th of September, being then at York with an army collected against the Scottish people, but his own men sullen and discontented like the rest of the nation, the king told the great council of the lords, whom he had called to meet him there, that he would summon another parliament, to assemble on the 3rd of November. The soldiers of the Covenant had now forced their way into England, and had taken possession of the northern counties, where the coals are got. As it would never do to be without coals, and as the king's troops could make no head against the Covenanters so full of gloomy zeal, a truce was made, and a treaty with Scotland was taken into consideration. Meanwhile the northern counties paid the Covenanters to leave the coals alone, and keep quiet. We have now disposed of the short parliament. We have next to see what memorable things were done by the long one. Second part, the long parliament assembled on the 3rd of November, 1641. That day week the Earl of Strafford arrived from York, very sensible that the spirited and determined men who formed that parliament were no friends towards him, who had not only deserted the cause of the people, but who had on all occasions opposed himself to their liberties. The king told him, for his comfort, that the parliament should not hurt one hair of his head. But, on the very next day Mr. Pym, in the House of Commons, and with great solemnity, impeached the Earl of Strafford as a traitor. He was immediately taken into custody, and fell from his proud height. It was the 22nd of March, before he was brought to trial in Westminster Hall, where, although he was very ill, and suffered great pain, he defended himself with such ability and majesty, that it was doubtful whether he would not get the best of it. But on the 13th day of the trial, Pym produced in the House of Commons a copy of some notes of a council, found by young Sir Harry Vane in a red velvet cabinet belonging to his father, Secretary Vane, who sat at the council table with the Earl, in which Strafford had distinctly told the king that he was free from all rules and obligations of government, and might do with his people whatever he liked, and in which he had added, "You have an army in Ireland, that you may employ to reduce this kingdom to obedience." It was not clear whether by the words "this kingdom" he had really meant England or Scotland. But the Parliament contended that he meant England, and this was treason. At the same sitting of the House of Commons it was resolved to bring in a bill of attainder declaring the treason to have been committed. In preference to proceeding with the trial by impeachment, which would have required the treason to be proved. So, a bill was brought in at once, was carried through the House of Commons by a large majority, and was sent up to the House of Lords. While it was still uncertain whether the House of Lords would pass it, and the king consent to it, Pym disclosed to the House of Commons that the king and queen had both been plotting with the officers of the army to bring up the soldiers and control the parliament, and also to introduce 200 soldiers into the Tower of London, to effect the Earl's escape. The plotting with the army was revealed by one George Goring, the son of a lord of that name, a bad fellow who was one of the original plotters, and turned traitor. The king had actually given his warrant for the admission of the 200 men into the tower, and they would have got into, but for the refusal of the governor, a sturdy Scotchman of the name of Balfour, to admit them. These matters being made public, great numbers of people began to riot outside the Houses of Parliament, and to cry out for the execution of the Earl of Strafford, as one of the king's chief instruments against them. The bill passed the House of Lords, while the people were in this state of agitation, and was laid before the king for his assent, together with another bill declaring that the Parliament then assembled should not be dissolved or adjourned without their own consent. the king not unwilling to save a faithful servant, though he had no great attachment for him, was in some doubt what to do. But he gave his consent to both bills, although he in his heart believed that the bill against the Earl of Strafford was unlawful and unjust. The Earl had written to him, telling him that he was willing to die for his sake. But he had not expected that his royal master would take him at his word quite so readily, for, when he heard his doom, he laid his hand upon his heart, and said, "Put not your trust in princes." The king, who never could be straightforward and plain, through one single day, or through one single sheet of paper, wrote a letter to the lords, and sent it by the young Prince of Wales, entreating them to prevail with the commons, that unfortunate man should fulfill the natural course of his life in a close imprisonment. In the postscript to the very same letter, he added, if he must die, it were charity to reprieve him till Saturday. If there had been any doubt of his fate, this weakness and meanness would have settled it. The very next day, which was the 12th of May, he was brought out to be beheaded on Tower Hill. Archbishop Laud, who had been so fond of having people's ears cropped off and their noses slit, was now confined in the tower too, and when the Earl went by his window to his death, he was there, at his request, to give him his blessing. They had been great friends in the king's cause, and the Earl had written to him in the days of their power that he thought it would be an admirable thing to have Mr. Hampden publicly whipped for refusing to pay the ship money. However, those high and mighty doings were over now, and the Earl went his way to death with dignity and heroism. The governor wished him to get into a coach at the tower gate, for fear the people should tear him to pieces. But he said it was all one to him, whether he died by the axe, or by the people's hands. So, he walked, with a firm tread and a stately look, and sometimes pulled off his hat to them as he passed along. They were profoundly quiet. He made a speech on the scaffold from some notes he had prepared. The paper was found lying there after his head was struck off, and one blow of the axe killed him, in the 49th year of his age. This bold and daring act, the Parliament accompanied by other famous measures, all originating, as even this did, in the king's having so grossly and so long abused his power. The name of delinquents was applied to all sheriffs, and other officers who had been concerned in raising the ship money, or any other money, from the people, in an unlawful manner. The Hampden judgment was reversed. The judges who had decided against Hampden were called upon to give large securities that they would take such consequences as Parliament might impose upon them, and one was arrested as he sat in High Court and carried off to prison. Laud was impeached. The unfortunate victims whose ears had been cropped and whose noses had been slit were brought out of prison in triumph, and a bill was passed declaring that a parliament should be called every third year, and that if the king and the king's officers did not call it, the people should assemble of themselves and summon it, as of their own right and power. Great illuminations and rejoicings took place over all these things, and the country was wildly excited. That the Parliament took advantage of this excitement, and stirred them up by every means, there is no doubt. But you are always to remember those 12 long years, during which the king had tried so hard, whether he really could do any wrong or not. All this time there was a great religious outcry against the right of the bishops to sit in Parliament, to which the Scottish people particularly objected. The English were divided on this subject, and, partly on this account and, partly because they had had foolish expectations that the Parliament would be able to take off nearly all the taxes, numbers of them sometimes wavered and inclined towards the king. I believe myself that if, at this or almost any other period of his life, the king could have been trusted by any man, not out of his senses, he might have saved himself and kept his throne. But, on the English army being disbanded, He plotted with the officers again, as he had done before, and established the fact beyond all doubt by putting his signature of approval to a petition against the parliamentary leaders, which was drawn up by certain officers. When the Scottish army was disbanded, he went to Edinburgh in 4 days, which was going very fast at that time, to plot again, and so darkly too, that it is difficult to decide what his whole object was. Some suppose that he wanted to gain over the Scottish Parliament, as he did in fact gain over, by presents and favors, many Scottish lords and men of power. Some think that he went to get proofs against the parliamentary leaders in England of their having treasonably invited the Scottish people to come and help them. With whatever object he went to Scotland, he did little good by going. At the instigation of the Earl of Montrose, a desperate man who was then in prison for plotting, he tried to kidnap 3 Scottish lords who escaped. A committee of the Parliament at home, who had followed to watch him, writing an account of this incident, as it was called, to the Parliament, the Parliament made a fresh stir about it, were, or feigned to be, much alarmed for themselves, and wrote to the Earl of Essex, the commander-in-chief, for a guard to protect them. It is not absolutely proved that the king plotted in Ireland besides, but it is very probable that he did, and that the queen did, and that he had some wild hope of gaining the Irish people over to his side, by favoring a rise among them. Whether or no, they did rise in a most brutal and savage rebellion, in which, encouraged by their priests, they committed such atrocities upon numbers of the English, of both sexes, and of all ages, as nobody could believe, but for their being related on oath by eyewitnesses. Whether 100,000 or 200,000 Protestants were murdered in this outbreak is uncertain, but that it was as ruthless and barbarous an outbreak as ever was known among any savage people is certain. The king came home from Scotland, determined to make a great struggle for his lost power. He believed that, through his presence and favors, Scotland would take no part against him, and the Lord Mayor of London received him with such a magnificent dinner that he thought he must have become popular again in England. It would take a good many Lord Mayors, however, to make a people, and the king soon found himself mistaken. Not so soon, though, but that there was a great opposition in the Parliament to a celebrated paper put forth by Pym and Hampden and the rest, called the Remonstrance, apostrophe which set forth all the illegal acts that the king had ever done, but politely laid the blame of them on his bad advisers. Even when it was passed and presented to him, the king still thought himself strong enough to discharge Balfour from his command in the Tower, and to put in his place a man of bad character, to whom the Commons instantly objected, and whom he was obliged to abandon. At this time, the old outcry about the bishops became louder than ever, and the old Archbishop of York was so near being murdered as he went down to the House of Lords, being laid hold of by the mob and violently knocked about, in return for very foolishly scolding a shrill boy who was yelping out "No bishops!" Apostrophe apostrophe that he sent for all the bishops who were in town, and proposed to them to sign a declaration that, as they could no longer without danger to their lives attend their duty in Parliament, they protested against the lawfulness of everything done in their absence. This they asked the king to send to the House of Lords, which he did. Then the House of Commons impeached the whole party of bishops, and sent them off to the Tower. Taking no warning from this, but encouraged by there being a moderate party in the Parliament who objected to these strong measures, the king, on the 3rd of January, 1642, took the rashest step that ever was taken by mortal man. Of his own accord and without advice, he sent the Attorney General to the House of Lords, to accuse of treason certain members of Parliament who as popular leaders were the most obnoxious to him: Lord Kimbolton, Sir Arthur Haselrig, Denzil Hollis, John Pym — they used to call him King Pym, He possessed such power and looked so big, John Hampden and William Strode. The houses of those members he caused to be entered, and their papers to be sealed up. At the same time, he sent a messenger to the House of Commons demanding to have the five gentlemen who were members of that house immediately produced. To this the House replied that they should appear as soon as there was any legal charge against them, and immediately adjourned. Next day, the House of Commons sent into the city to let the Lord Mayor know that their privileges are invaded by the King, and that there is no safety for anybody or anything. Then, when the five members are gone out of the way, down comes the King himself, with all his guard, and from 200 to 300 gentlemen and soldiers, of whom the greater part were armed. These he leaves in the hall, and then, with his nephew at his side, goes into the house, takes off his hat, and walks up to the Speaker's chair. The Speaker leaves it, the King stands in front of it, looks about him steadily for a little while, and says he has come for those five members. No one speaks, and then he calls John Pym by name. No one speaks, and then he calls Denzel Hollis by name. No one speaks, and then he asks the Speaker of the House where those five members are. The Speaker, answering on his knee, nobly replies that he is the servant of that house, and that he has neither eyes to see, nor tongue to speak, anything but what the house commands him. Upon this, the King, beaten from that time evermore, replies that he will seek them himself, for they have committed treason, and goes out, with his hat in his hand, amid some audible murmurs from the members. No words can describe the hurry that arose out of doors when all this was known. The five members had gone for safety to a house in Coleman Street, in the city, where they were guarded all night, and indeed the whole city watched in arms like an army. At 10 o'clock in the morning, the King, already frightened at what he had done, came to the Guildhall, with only half a dozen lords, and made a speech to the people, hoping they would not shelter those whom he accused of treason. Next day, he issued a proclamation for the apprehension of the five members, but the Parliament minded it so little that they made great arrangements for having them brought down to Westminster in great state, 5 days afterwards. The King was so alarmed now at his own imprudence, if not for his own safety, that he left his palace at Whitehall, and went away with his queen and children to Hampton Court. It was the 11th of May, when the five members were carried in state and triumph to Westminster. They were taken by water. The river could not be seen for the boats on it, and the five members were hemmed in by barges full of men and great guns, ready to protect them, at any cost. Along the Strand a large body of the train bands of London, under their commander, Skippon, marched to be ready to assist the little fleet. Beyond them, came a crowd who choked the streets, roaring incessantly about the bishops and the papists, and crying out contemptuously as they passed Whitehall, "What has become of the King?" ... With this great noise outside the House of Commons, and with great silence within, Mr. Pym rose, and informed the House of the great kindness with which they had been received in the city. Upon that, the House called the sheriffs in and thanked them, and requested the train bands, under their commander Skippon, to guard the House of Commons every day. Then, came 4,000 men on horseback out of Buckinghamshire, offering their services as a guard to, and bearing a petition to the King, complaining of the injury that had been done to Mr. Hampden, who was their county man and much beloved and honored. When the King set off for Hampton Court, the gentlemen and soldiers who had been with him followed him out of town as far as Kingston upon Thames. Next day, Lord Digby came to them from the King at Hampton Court, in his coach and six, to inform them that the King accepted their protection. This, the Parliament said, was making war against the kingdom, and Lord Digby fled abroad. The Parliament then immediately applied themselves to getting hold of the military power of the country, well knowing that the king was already trying hard to use it against them, and that he had secretly sent the Earl of Newcastle to Hull to secure a valuable Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.